Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out the show this week. A special episode. Two journalists I really admire from NBC News and MSNBC, Katie Turin and Jacob Soboroff. They have a really interesting docuseries out called American Swamp that looks at political dysfunction in America and covers a lot of interesting ground and somebody and something that I thought you all should know about. A really cool conversation with them. They've traveled the country and really explored some stuff. And basically, what you take away from it is maybe you want to leave America and live in another country. That's all I'm saying. Or in the woods alone. Okay, enjoy Katie Turr and Jacob Soboroff. And in this interview with them, I think it'll be pretty eye-opening. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. I've been watching a really great docuseries on MSNBC called American Swamp, co-hosted by my guests, award-winning journalists from NBC News and MSNBC. It's Katie Turr and Jacob Soboroff. Nice to have you guys on the show. I'm really excited to talk to you about this series that you guys have done.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got the fourth installment coming up, which is A Bill to Nowhere Infrastructure. But I wanted to take a larger view of things because, Jacob, you said something recently and defined swamp for me in a way that I hadn't thought about it. But you said the swamp is that space that explains the gap between Washington and America. And I was wondering, as you did your reporting on this, did you come away with the sense that the swamp is even worse than you thought and the gap is bigger than you imagine?
Yeah, I did. And the reason is that, you know, we think about Washington being smoke-filled rooms and kind of, you know, backslapping deals between people who have influence. But once you really look at it closely, you know, some of the stuff that gets thrown around about Washington, that there's legalized bribery, legalized money laundering, it kind of sounds extreme, but it is the reality of what's happening in our nation's capital, both the campaign finance system. And in this episode, you'll see Katie has this amazing conversation with Ken Buck, the congressman from Colorado, a Republican who basically admits you got to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars if you even want to be in a position of leadership within your own party in Congress.
And he said your bills heard. Right. And he says this other thing, makes so much sense that you don't have the expert staff that you used to have who could really help you understand things and get things done properly, because those are all filled by lobbyists. Isn't that right, Katie?
Yeah. And that's been that way since the 90s. And Newt Gingrich, believe it or not, was the person who got rid of those expert staffers. And those staffers didn't work just for the Democrats or just for the Republicans. They weren't partisan staffers. They were straight up expert staffers that advised lawmakers on bills and how to write bills. That's my baby you're hearing in the background.
It could be me also. You never know.
Yeah, exactly. That's Jacob's stomach gurgling.
It could be. Anyway, they're not there any longer, and they haven't been replaced. So what you have are lawmakers, and Ken Buck says they don't frankly have time to read or mark up bills because the majority of their time is, Teddy, what are you doing? Taken up by raising money, fundraising all the time. This is just what you do for most of your time during the week. So what happens is lobbyists come in and they write up bills or they lobby to kill bills. And when things aren't happening, Ken Buck said that it's almost better for lawmakers, because doing something is potentially dangerous. A special interest could spend against you in your next election. So sitting there and doing nothing is more politically expedient than getting anything done for the American public.
That's why this series is so good and people need to see it, because it's this nuance of, it starts to explain things. You know, I mean, I look at our public servants and I really feel like most of our public servants, you know, not all, but most have their own agenda. And the agenda is to get into that position and keep that position and by definition be risk averse.
That's how the system is set up. So think about what happens when you have the ultimate self-dealer, Donald Trump, come in and become the president of the United States. He sets an example for the politicians in Washington to just follow his lead. For him, everything at the end of the day is about his business interests and self-serving himself, regardless of what you say. And in the second episode, you know, we took a close look at Mar-a-Lago and his other properties, how he's profiting off of the presidency. And so the fish rots from the head. And so when you have the head of state in the United States government setting an example saying, you know, this is about him, not about the American people, despite what he actually says, the words that come out of his mouth, you know, how there is no accountability in Washington, D.C. for people behaving this way.
Yeah. And
it's not just Washington. This is permeating the rest of our system. There's news out of West Virginia that the governor of West Virginia, who owns a hotel down there, big property down there, and said that he wouldn't take any money spent by public groups on the hotel, is making money off his hotel from education groups spending there, from lobbyists eating there. I mean, it sounds just like what Trump is doing with Mar-a-Lago or with the Washington, D.C. hotel. I do want to make one point, though, and I don't think it's fair to paint every lawmaker with a broad brush to say that they're all just in it for themselves. I think a lot of them do get into government because they want to make a difference, and they want to fix the broken system. They want to fix the roads in their town, but they get there and they realize very quickly that it's almost impossible to get any of that done nowadays because of all the lobbyists, because of all the fundraising, because of how the system is just fundamentally broken. And it didn't used to always be that way. It did function a lot better decades ago. It really was broken in the 90s when Newt Gingrich became the Speaker of the House and President Clinton was around. Yeah. That's when the system just cleaved in half. And we haven't found a way to stitch it back together yet.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because Katie, you said, you know, when you're young, you're idealistic. You think, oh, people come in and they get voted in and they care and they'll fix things. And then as you get older, you realize things aren't so simple. And again, I agree with you. They're not all bad people, or you know. But so how does a young person, given the way things are now, how does a young person become invested in our political system and maybe serving and all of that, given how it just looks so like it's just you throw your hands up.
Vote in your local elections. Vote. State legislatures are so important. We don't, you know, we talk about federal elections and make such a big deal out of them, but ultimately the state legislatures are the ones that draw the districting maps. So they're the ones that allow these extreme lawmakers, these extreme candidates to gain more favor, because we have so many districts that are just either deep, deep red or deep, deep blue. There's very little moderation any longer in the middle. And that's why voting in a local election is so important, because it will affect what happens on the federal scale.
Also, Paul, just real quick, you know, Katie and I have known each other forever. We've been friends since high school, which is part of the reason it's been so cool to do this project. But we were like that. You know, we were young and idealistic kids growing up in Los Angeles together as well. And you get really disillusioned about the process, I think, in our business because of how frustrating it can be. But going out and getting to see this stuff for ourselves makes you realize that, no pun intended, because this episode is about infrastructure, but there are lights at the end of the tunnel. You know, for infrastructure, we went to LA, we went home to LA to see how they're handling things here. And the state and local governments have partnered up to find some of the money to fix some of this stuff that the federal government either refuses to do or won't fund fully. And with campaign finance, we went to Montana, you know, to see how they're making everybody disclose the money that's going into all these donations. And so I think if you look a little deeper, if you spend a little more time, frankly, watching less talking heads and doing more research, you'll see that there are ways out of all of this. And Katie's right. You have to vote in order to make that happen, but you also have to invest the time and energy into understanding that it doesn't have to be this way and not feeling resigned to the fact that everything's screwed, you know?
Support the politicians who are supporting those policies, the Disclose Act, or politicians who are coming out and being honest and saying, if you want to fix our roads, we got to raise the gas tax, we got to raise this tax, and it's going to be 1 cent, supporting them and defying the special interest groups that are out there, you know, spending money against them.
Well, you point out that, you know, Trump was going in the room saying, "Oh, let the Democrats were talking to Republicans about a small tax increase, gas tax increase to do infrastructure."
Gas tax, exactly.
And he walked in and was like, "Yeah, do some more." And then the Republicans shut it down. And to me, infrastructure is such a no-brainer for everybody, every politician to win. Like, is it simply because the Republicans don't want taxes raised to do it? Why can't that get passed?
Neither party does, Paul. Neither party. President Obama did not want to raise a gas tax either in his first term or ahead of the midterms because, and I think it was Ray LaHood, his transportation secretary, who said it, it wouldn't be good electorally. So politicians they have their self-interests in mind, and certainly, as Katie said, not everybody does this, but it's the way that the system works. They want to preserve their incumbency before anything else, even if that means putting themselves ahead of the improvements in our infrastructure that could help the American people, or in gun control legislation that could save lives. Name the issue, and the example still remains the same about how the system gets in the way of fundamental changes, because what comes first is the politician's self-preservation. You know,
but I think there are signs that political bravery can be rewarded, and we saw this in Los Angeles. Eric Garcetti got the voters of Los Angeles to say yes to a permanent tax to fund infrastructure projects there, a permanent tax increase to fund infrastructure projects there. The governor of Minnesota did the same sort of thing, and he had special interests spending against him, and they did not prevail. He won. Ray LaHood talked about this as well in a transportation hearing meeting that Jacob and I went to earlier this year. They were trying to convince lawmakers that campaigning on raising a tax would not necessarily be the end of their career. And the governor of Montana, when we were talking about dark money and the ways in which dark money is infecting and corrupting our politics, he ran on the Disclose Act and had a ton of special interests, the Koch brothers, spending against him. And he still won. And the Disclose Act still stands. So I think there's room for political bravery. Those politicians, though, just need to be rewarded by the voters.
Yeah, and I think that reward is rooted in a fundamental belief that people are fundamentally decent and smart, meaning if you give them the choice of, okay, I'm not going to hit 7 potholes on the way to work and I'm going to have to pay a little extra in gas for it, they'll be like, that's worth it. You know, it's just like
they would say no shit, because it makes their lives better on a daily basis.
And the politicians need to trust that. The politicians need to trust that the voter can think that way, and then they can get things done.
Well, who knows how to improve our lives better than ourselves? You know what I'm saying? It's like nobody. I don't know why anybody thinks people that go to Washington, D.C. understand what you or I or Katie go through day to day better than we do ourselves. And that's the disconnect. That is the swamp that you mentioned at the beginning. What I really believe the swamp is, it's that gap, whether it's physical or metaphysical, between our daily lives and the way Washington interprets what our daily lives are like and what our priorities are. And that's the thing. It's like, how do we get our voices to be listened to and to be heard. And, these things that we're talking about.
Yeah, they have to remember that they're representing people, human beings who live lives and have setbacks just like themselves, not robots. So it's like
corporations.
Right. When a politician messes up or has a controversy, if you just go to the public and say, look, yeah, I did it. I'm human. I screwed up. I'm sorry.
Mark Sanford is a great example of that before he got primaried because of his anti-Trump stance. Right. But he was a great example of somebody who said, you know, he had that affair and he came out and he said, I messed up. I'm fallible. And he won re-election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the vote in the segment about voting. We rank 122nd in the world. And is it because people have just given up saying, hey, my vote doesn't matter and nothing I do matters and the big corporations run everything?
Well, Katie and I like to argue about this. I think, and, you know, feel free to disagree, Katie. I think the vast majority of people don't vote because they just have a fundamental mistrust of the system. I, for a long time, was an activist pushing for election reform and believed that structural barriers were the main reason. And while I think that they're incredibly, incredibly important and keep a lot of people away from the polls, most people don't vote because they think whatever I do, my life stays kind of shitty. And, and so what's in it for me to go when I vote for Barack Obama or Donald Trump or whoever it is, things stay pretty consistent for me. And so, you know, I'm going to sit this next one out. That's what I think. People do not feel motivated or inspired by our system or our politicians. And so too many people end up staying home. I honestly don't know how to fix that.
Katie, what's your view on it?
Well, it's that, but it's farther. It goes beyond that. It's people who are frustrated and they don't think their lives are going to change. And that's a big portion of it. I think it's people who assume I live in a blue state or I live in a red state. It doesn't matter. My vote doesn't actually matter because my state's going to vote a certain way. But I also think that it's, we have a problem with the way that we educate from the ground up on how to participate in our government. We, again, spend so much time on federal elections that the majority of people just don't bother to vote in their local elections. They don't think it matters. They're not plugged in locally. So if you're not plugged in locally, again, if you can't fix it from the ground up, if you're not participating at home, it's just going to get more and more out of touch with your lives and your daily needs up at the top. So it's apathy, it's distrust, it's just a lack of education. It's a number of things combined that makes us, and quite frankly, an embarrassing position around the world. I mean, yeah. It's embarrassing that we're 122nd and we're supposed to be, quote unquote, the greatest democracy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and we found that I used to write on The Daily Show, and we found that like we would get so outraged by things, and sometimes we'd do field pieces. And if we had a nickel for every time somebody said, what are you going to do? They're all the same. Yeah, they're all the same. Like, it's like they just gave up, you know? And it's like, no, you've got to make sure you have a voice and you exercise that voice and you have some impact. There's an installment on dark money, and the Arizona energy, solar energy thing was eye-opening to me and just gave me chills about how nefarious dark money can be. And just tell people real quick kind of what's going on in Arizona.
Well, you know, one example I think that really stuck out to us in doing this is in our first episode, we looked at the influence of money in politics, and I had no idea, but in Arizona, ostensibly the sunniest state in the union, only around 6% of consumers have solar power on their home. And, you know, you sort of think, what the hell is going on with that? It turns out that, the energy industry, in particular the Koch brothers and APS, Arizona Public Service, the utility there, have invested in political campaigns to support regulators that prefer nuclear power and natural gas over solar. And that is because, obviously, those companies have direct financial interests in them. And so instead of in Arizona being able to have solar power in your home and make money back off the grid, you actually have to pay basically a fine or a tax in order to have solar power on your home. It's incomprehensible when you think about it, but there's a real and concrete reason behind it. It's corporations are allowed to control politicians with legalized bribery. In order to put policies that benefit corporations over people. And that's, and that is what's happening right now in Arizona.
I tell you, the series is so great. The next installment, the final installment is coming up August 18th. And every one of them is just so educational. And I tended to do this for a living and do political satire for a living. And I thought I knew a lot, but man, there's a lot I didn't know. Real quick before you guys go, I really loved your coverage as road warriors during the election. And when did you, each of you, what was the moment where you thought this guy Trump actually could win? Was there a moment at all for either of you? And if so, when was it?
It was after John McCain slam. You know, he went after John McCain, and I, you know, at the time I got a call from Sean Spicer, who was still just working with the RNC and not with the Trump campaign. And he was like, this guy's done. It's not happening. He's over. Republican voters will not stand for him going after a war hero. And I said, are you sure about that? And he was adamant. And then I went to Mobile, Alabama a short time after that for a Trump rally. It was in August of 2015, and 20,000 people showed up. 20,000 people in Deep Red, Alabama, a place that's supposedly very pro-American troops, pro-POWs, and they all were cheering him on, and I asked about John McCain, and nobody cared. They didn't like John McCain. They liked Trump better. And I thought, if this is the attitude that I'm seeing here, I can imagine what I'll see in other places.
Yeah, that's incredible. Listen, thank you so much for doing this. I don't want to keep you guys any longer. And MSNBC, American Swamp, it is a really great docuseries. And the last installment is Sunday, August 18th. And the other installments you can see online. And thank you so much for doing this, guys, and keep doing the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate it.
And good luck with the baby.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. American Swamp. Really interesting docuseries. Check it out. It's worth it. And follow me, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Mercurio, and spread the word around about the podcast. Always good to add listeners. And we will see you next week.